morning is taken from Mark chapter 10. They came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him, told him to be quiet. But he shouted out all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. We're pleased to have Michael Sider Rhodes with us this morning, graduate of Eastern University. He's had a particular passion for the poor, has worked with the Pittsburgh Project, the Pittsburgh Semester, and is now working with the Coro group, training and helping and developing people who want to do internships working in the city as well. Please welcome Michael Sider Rhodes.
So Peter Pan lives in my house, and he's been there for over a year now. He comes in every morning about 6 a.m., and he leaves every evening at about 7 p.m. He lives, that is, through the imagination of my 5-year-old and my 3-year-old daughters. They love the story of Peter Pan, so at first my wife and I would just read it to them about 5,000 times. And then we bought a CD so somebody else could read it to them. And then they began to act it out, and they became Peter Pan, and they became John and Michael and Wendy, even Nana the dog. So one day last summer, Anna, the 5-year-old, was acting things out, and they decided that I would be Peter, which was actually a step up from the day before when I had been Tinkerbell for a number of hours. And everything was going fine, and we're acting out the drama until we had to run an errand. That is, until we had to go out into public. Now, we decided to go to the farmer's market in my neighborhood, and they insisted as we went there that the drama would continue. So you need to picture the scene here, right? It's a sunny day, it's a lovely day, and we're walking out to the farmer's market, and my firstborn child has on a leotard and a tutu and a tiara, and we get to the farmer's market, and she drops to all fours, and she begins barking because she's Nana the dog, and she's barking loudly in the farmer's market. And at this point, I'm supposed to respond in Peter Pan's voice that dogs are not allowed in Neverland. Now, I don't know what the farmer's market looks like here in Beaver Falls, but in the East Liberty neighborhood of Pittsburgh, where I'm from, there are not too many grown men talking in high-pitched British accents to 3-foot barking ballerinas. So parenting is a humbling experience. But parenting is also endlessly fascinating for me. And part of the fascination with my daughters is their love of stories. Their little lives are saturated by stories. We read them books, they hear fairy tales, they listen to them on CD, they create their own stories. It's how they make sense of their lives. If they learn a new word, if they meet a new person, if they get in time out, it comes out in their stories. And I suspect that part of the reason that they like the story of Peter Pan is because they can see themselves in it. It's the tale of small, unlikely heroes. Kids who take on pirates and win. My daughters, who are also small, use this story to navigate a world of big people. And my daughters are not the only ones who do this. They're not the only ones who use stories to make sense of their lives. I think we all do this. Stories have a way of capturing our head and our heart and our guts. When we try to speak the deep mysteries of our lives, we often do so through stories. So it doesn't surprise me that the Bible is chock full of stories. It doesn't surprise me that the record of God's movement in the world comes to us through narratives. I want to look at a few of these stories today, and I'll lay my cards on the table from the outset. I love the stories of the Bible, and one of the reasons that I love them, one of the main reasons, is that in the stories in the Bible, it is full of unlikely heroes, just like the story of Peter Pan. Again and again, narratives in the Bible focus on people who are lost and broken and marginal, folks who are looking weird and whacked. And again, in these stories in the Bible, God abides. God resides with exactly those kind of people and makes something beautiful. Think about a few stories from the Bible. The Christian narrative begins in the Old Testament with the Hebrew people, God's chosen people. And who does God pick for his chosen people? A small clan of weak folks, often battered by their powerful neighbors. The chosen people of God live as slaves under the Egyptians. They live as homeless migrants in the desert. They're refugees under the captivity of the Babylonians. And more often than not, they're strangers in somebody else's land. You can even see this in the name, in the word Hebrew. It's related to the word haparu. And the word haparu referred to people who lived on the fringes of society, folks who didn't have a country of their own. So maybe the Hebrew people were not so much an ethnic group, but a social group, a group of outsiders. That's who God picked for his people. And then God does something else. God decides to dwell among people. He dwells among his chosen people. And when Jesus is born, the Jewish people are now outsiders. Now they're under the thumb of the Roman Empire. Most Jews had lost their land. They were in debt. They had few political rights. So Jesus enters the world as an outsider, as a marginal figure. And he's even marginal among his own people. He's from this podunk town, Nazareth. He's not from Jerusalem. He's not from Rome. He's from Nazareth. In the Gospel of John, you may remember that the disciple Philip tells Nathanael that the Messiah has come, that he is Jesus of Nazareth. And Nathanael responds, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" It was a fair question because God made a strange choice. Or how about this? You know that long and boring list of names at the beginning of Matthew? It records the lineage of Jesus. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob, and on and on. At first glance, it looks like a traditional list of names. All right, it is primarily men. It establishes Jesus as a thoroughly Jewish person in the line of King David. But in the middle of this, there are four surprises, because there's four times in the list where women are mentioned. And not only that, these women are Gentiles. And one of those Gentiles was a prostitute. So what does it mean that the lineage of the Son of God includes Rahab, a woman and a Gentile and a prostitute, an outsider, three times over? I'm thinking that Matthew's trying to tell us something. And I think he's trying to tell us that Jesus is an outsider as well. So then think about Jesus' life. It wasn't enough that he was born an outsider. He spends most of his time associating with folks on the margins and holding them up as models for us. Think about that familiar and sweet passage from Matthew 18 where the disciples ask who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus pulls out a kid. Now, most of my life, I thought this was just a sweet story. And maybe this was a sweet kid, right? Maybe she was dressed up in a tiara and a tutu. But however cute she was, I don't think that was Jesus' main point in bringing her out. Here's why. In Jesus' day, children, like women, were a form of property. Husbands and fathers had an authority over women and kids that we would think is obscene. So when Jesus pulls out the kid, it's not a sweet move, but it's a radical move. And here's the explanation that Jesus gives for bringing out the kid. He says, "Unless you turn and become like the children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. So whoever will lower himself and be like this child, that person is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." The point, it seems to me, is that Jesus overturns the hierarchy of the day The outsiders are now in. The old categories don't make sense anymore. Other outcasts play key roles in the Gospels. Mark and Luke, for example, record the story of a man who's tormented by demons. He lives in the mountains, in the tombs. He thrashes about so violently that he's got to have chains on him. But then he breaks out of his chains. So I imagine this guy who is bloody, who has crazed eyes, who has this wild voice, maybe he's naked. He comes to Jesus, and Jesus doesn't send him away, but he heals him. And it's not just that. The healing might be enough, but there's another surprising piece. The demons are called legion, and when Jesus casts them out, he sends them into a herd of pigs who go racing off the cliff and then drown. Now, for many of us, that added material is just a little bit weird. But for the people in his day, they would have heard something different. Legion was a military term used in the Roman Empire. So Jesus not only embraces this crazed demoniac, but he dismisses the Roman Empire. The rulers of this world he sends off as a herd of hogs go over this cliff. Or how about the story of Bartimaeus that you heard? This blind beggar sees Jesus passing, and so he starts to yell out, "Jesus, have mercy on me." Everybody tells him to shut up. He's an embarrassment, right? He's supposed to stay invisible. But old Bart just keeps yelling some more, "Jesus, have mercy on me." So Jesus stops, and he asks him, "Bartimaeus, what do you want?" And I love his answer, so simple. "I want to see." And here's the irony of it. He's blind as a bat, but he can see better than anybody else there because he's the one who has the faith. And that's what Jesus tells him. "Your faith has made you well." It goes on and on like this, story after story of folks on the margins who are held up by Jesus as examples of the faith. So what does this all mean for us? The stories of the Bible do us no good if they don't make sense to us. The real power of stories is that we connect to them. We see them connecting to our lives in some fashion. We see that character as connected to this character. Here's another way to think about it. A story becomes powerful when we overlap it with other stories that make sense to us. My daughters, incidentally, are very good at this. In their imaginative play, they're always linking stories together. They're good at this in a 5 and a 3-year-old sort of way. So when they link stories together, there'll be a story about Peter Pan, and Winnie the Pooh will appear right in the middle of it, right? They'll have some story about the Lorax berating Goldilocks for knocking down trees. And it gets really weird when they start to layer in religious elements, right? So this is a true story. My daughter is convinced that St. Peter is not the rock of the church, but Peter Pan is the rock of the church. That baby Jesus was not born in Jerusalem, but he was born in Neverland. These are stories that emerge from my daughter, right? I have hope, despite the fact that they're a little bit off on some of the details, that my daughters are making good effort here, because I really think we need to find connections between the stories of the Bible and our own lives. My kids are doing that heretically right now, but it's a good effort. And I want to do the same thing, right? Not advance heresy, but I want to try to link the stories of the Bible to my own life. All right, so here's one possible connection. I live in the city, and except for 4 years when I was in college, I have lived in cities all my life. Chicago, Philadelphia, now I live in Pittsburgh. So I'm curious, do these stories of the Bible connect to the city? I think they do, and I'll give you couple thoughts on this. The Bible helps me see my city in a different way. The newspaper tells me about the mayor, tells me about the stock price of big companies in the city, but the newspaper doesn't tell me about the homeless guy that I see when I'm biking into work. Now, that guy might make the news if he killed somebody, but if he just sits there on the side of the road, he's not news, he's just nuisance. And yet, Bartimaeus was also a beggar, and he was a model of faith. And so I'm wondering if this homeless guy is also a model of faith. In fact, I wonder how many saints live on the streets of my city, if only I had the eyes of faith to see them that way.
Maybe through the eyes of faith, I could even see the face of God in people of my city, especially folks who are on the margins. After all, the Bible begins by declaring that human beings are made in the image of God. That is, we image God, we reflect God. And if that's true, maybe the diverse array of human beings in the city, people of different colors and cultures, different ethnicities and eccentricities, maybe all of those people help us to see the multifaceted face of God. So if we look at folks that are just like ourselves, maybe we only see part of God. And if we want to see more of God, maybe what we need to do is step out of ourselves into places like the city, where we can encounter a whole range of folks, especially folks who are on the fringes. So I think the Bible has something to say about the place I come from, the city. But here's the more important question. Do these biblical narratives that I've been talking about have anything to say to you? Is there any way that I might overlap the biblical story with your own story? And here I'm on really shaky grounds, because except for a few of you, I don't know your story. But let me make some effort at a few links nonetheless. I've spent most of my adult life working with college students, including some from Geneva. So it matters to me what kind of connections are possible between the biblical story and your own. All right, here's two possible connections. In college, you're supposed to figure out who you are and what you want to do in life. And after that, you're supposed to pick a relevant major in order to learn how you do what you want to do in life. And this is supposed to happen in 4 years. The college students that I work with tend to be late in these 4 years, about the end of the 4 years. They are smart and perceptive and reflective people. But most of them that I talk to still have tons of questions about what they want to do in life and how they want to do it. I think the Bible is full of stories of people who are battered and bruised and often very confused. So I think the Bible has a message for folks who are feeling a little confused. God abides with exactly those kind of people again and again, and something beautiful happens. So if you feel a bit lost, the Bible's got some good news. You have fine company. The Bible might be good news in a different kind of way also. If you're still trying to figure out who you want to be in life, what you want to do, how you want to get there, I think the stories of the Bible might help give some guidance. They might help by directing our attention to the margins for answers, for unlikely heroes, for insight. Now, I don't know exactly what that would look like for you, for your career, for where you live, for who you marry. I hardly know what it looks like for myself, but I wonder if the Bible gives us some hints. I wonder, for example, if maybe we would become a little less interested in rising up the social ladder, if we become a little bit less interested in getting a wad of cash, if we become a little bit less interested in getting a fine title, and instead, we'd be more interested in making connections to folks on the fringes, to outsiders. Maybe we'd be more keen to hang out with poor folks, or with ex-cons, or with your quirky old aunt who's losing her mind. In fact, maybe it's these folks, exactly these folks, who could teach us something about God. And hanging out with them could be beautiful. And maybe in those encounters, we would actually catch a glimpse of the face of God. Amen.